research leader and small fruit curator at the USDA National Clonal Germplasm Repository in Corvallis, Oregon. Dr. Kinghammer was selected as a curator for the collection in 1987 and has been the research leader since 1989. Her research focuses on the genetic resources of berry crops as well as mint and hop. Kim.
Thank you very much, Ksenia. Today I want to talk about cycles and the foundation of agriculture. I'm going to start with history, and it's, oh, Kim, you're going to give us a history lesson. But in May 15th, 1862, our great president, Abraham Lincoln, established the Department of Agriculture. What a foresighted individual he was. In about the 1890s, the scientists N.I. Vavilov and David Fairchild, who are our titans of the science that we work with, realized that crop wild relatives exist all over the world for the economically important crops of the day, the agricultural crops. They were outside of the countries in which these scientists resided. Vavilov had to get wheat that would be more cold hardy because they were experiencing famine in Russia. And Fairchild also realized that there was a lot of genetic resources outside of the country. So over time, pretty much right off in Russia, they established gene banks. It took until after the war, 1945, for the U.S. to establish the National Plant Germplasm System and recognize that a facility to preserve genetic resources was extremely critical. And then in the 60s, as we had 1960s, we had the Green Revolution going on. The consultative group established genetic resource centers, about 12 of them, throughout the tropical, subtropical parts of the globe where most of this genetic resources were located. Well, then we come to how does ARS fit into the National Plant Germplasm ARS and the ASHS, the American Society for Horticultural Science, fit into the National Plant Germplasm System, and we do, and there's cycles. And this is exciting for us to remember. In ASHS, in the 70s, there was a period of retirements, and people that had germplasm collections that were breeders, they were retiring. They realized that plant materials needed to be conserved. And so Howard Brooks and Dr. Barton heard what people were saying at the meetings. They wrote a paper that was published in Hort Science in 1977, a plan for the National Fruit and Nut Germplasm Repositories. Our founding mothers and fathers, and that would be in terms of Corvallis, Dr. Mel Westwood and Maxine Thompson lobbied hard to get a gene bank put at Corvallis. And this was the beginning of the U.S. clonal repositories, of which there are about 10. And we've heard from three of the repositories now, and my location in Corvallis, Oregon, fourth here, about the clonal germplasm. So the horticultural germplasm is propagated vegetatively or clonally, and it's a little different concept than the seeds. And in fact, when we joined the system, some of you may not realize that the database at the time, which was called GRIP, they didn't even have a location for a cultivar name. And so we had a lot of changing to do for the database management. And over time, they've realized that clonal plant germplasm is quite an important aspect of the National Plant Germplasm System. So as we've mentioned, We have four or five different objectives that we all do. We go out and collect or acquire plant material. We maintain this material, distribute, evaluate, and document this material, information about this material. And in our case in Corvallis, I think we have, I'm sorry, grapes are okay, but we have the best germplasm in the whole national plant germplasm system. We have the strawberries and the blueberries and the raspberries and black raspberries and hazelnut, mint, and hop. And we have, as John Priest pointed out, we have heritage cultivars, but we also have crop wild relatives of this material too, which makes it very significant. And some of the kinds of things that happen, if you go to a cranberry meeting, say, early on, and you mention that you have a white cranberry, and it gets the industry to thinking, and so they ask for white cranberries, and then they go on and develop juice, white cranberry juice. So things that we say and present as diverse material can develop into huge economic value for the crops, and the value-added parts are the crops that we work with. So at the National Clonal Germplasm Repository of Corvallis, we work with the Convention on the rules of the Convention on Biological Diversity, and of course the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture, which went into effect in 2004. When I happened to be on a plant collecting expedition in Hokkaido, but we had planned for that, so we had made sure we have bilateral agreements and we have mutual benefit of collecting germplasm now. And so all these things have changed over the time that I have been in the career of being a curator and research leader. We work also closely with the Global Crop Diversity Trust, and that would include Svalbard Seed Vault for long-term preservation of our genetic resources. So some of the value of some of the crops, we have 30 different genera that we work with, but we have eight main ones. Strawberries, the Fragaria, is one of our major crops. And I wanted to mention that in these crop wild relatives, we have a white fruited landrace that was initially from Chile. We had several plant collecting trips to Chile. And we also have the father, so that was the mother and the father, Fragaria virginiana from the U.S. are the parents of the hybrid strawberries that we have come to know in commerce. And again, white fruits have given ideas to for economic development. Some breeders are looking for white-fruited types of strawberries, and some are looking for dark-fruited types of strawberries. So having this representation of diversity is very useful. Our heritage fruit includes cultivars that were selected by George Darrow, George Waldo, and many others. Even a standard cultivar, Marshall, is requested quite frequently, and it's not available in the commercial trade. It's a soft berry, but people remember the taste of this strawberry, so we get many requests for this heritage cultivar. We have the reference collection that Dr. Roy Springhurst provided us for the parental lines that began the UC program. And even now, these cultivars are being mined for traits that are useful in breeding. And just for an example, in 2014, the United States produced 3 billion pounds of strawberries valued at $2.9 billion, and the fresh market strawberries accounted for 81%. A second crop that's one of our major crops is the pear collection. We have heritage pears that date back to China, 2,000 years old. The duck pear, for example, Yali. And we have Japanese, European, and Korean pairs as well to fill out the diversity. Sometimes there are red fleshed type pairs that are interesting. We have, of course, the industry big four pairs that are important in, to the commercial industry and their variants. And the value of non-Bartlett fresh production is about $264 million annually. But as Ben mentioned, with apples, the cider industry has become a great driving factor in pear genetic diversity and interest there. We have not only cider pears for cider, but there's a traditional British, well, European beverage called Perry. And we have a collection of 30 different pears that are for this type of pear cider. Hazelnuts is another exciting story. Of course, we have a disease that has been challenging the hazelnuts, Eastern filbert blight, and it is native to the eastern part of the United States. But it crept into Portland, Oregon vicinity in the 1960s, and now it has expanded its range down throughout the commercial production areas of Oregon. Oregon produces 98% of the hazelnuts for the U.S., and we're about the third largest in the world in terms of hazelnut production. Now, one, we can give figures such as this, the farm gate values, but another figure just to show how important hazelnuts are to Oregon and the region. In 2004, there were 20,000 acres of hazelnut that were grown in Oregon, and now, with the advent of new disease-resistant hazelnuts that Dr. Sean Mellenbacher has released, it's upwards of 70,000 acres being produced. Everywhere you go in up and down the valley in Oregon, you're seeing new hazelnut orchards being put in, and these are these resistant hazelnuts that Sean has released. How did he produce these? He screened our germplasm collection for using molecular markers and molecular tools for disease resistance to Eastern filbert blight. And then he also added tasty, larger nuts, blanching, and higher qualities. So the germplasm collection was extremely important to this crop as well. Blueberries, then we get to blueberries. We have in our collection heritage blueberries that were released, named and released by Frederick Coville and Elizabeth White. Some of these have been talked about in previous APS selections by Mark Ehlenfeld and others, that there's interesting stories in each of these cultivars, not enough time to talk about, but sometime if you want to talk blueberries, we can have a little chat about Rugel and all the exciting heritage material we have. But another thing about blueberries is they have a very plastic genome, I think anyway, because you can breed cultivars that can survive the cold. You can breed cultivars that survive the heat and don't have any chilling. And so right at the moment, the fresh fruit production value of high bush blueberries was $567 million in 2016 for the U.S., that is. But you know what's happened is the southern high bush blueberry, which has been, it's a hybrid that's incorporated wild blueberries such as Vaccinium darowii, has taken the world by storm. So Southern California, Mexico now has a huge crop of blueberries that didn't used to exist there. And now we can eat blueberries in at Christmas time, in December, in the winter time, where that was not able to be done 20 years ago. So these low-chill species have been incorporated as hybrids. The southern highbush blueberries are now being a very significant world crop because of the wild germplasm that we have. Of course, we protect our germplasm in greenhouses and screenhouses. We grow our hazelnuts and pears in orchards in the field. We have seed collections for preservation of wild species material. And up to now, we've had in vitro culture and cryogenic preservation research at our facility. Now we collaborate with Fort Collins and the scientists there for that activity. And we also coordinate with other gene banks such as Parlier, where we have a remote location for security of the germplasm storage. Next, I'd like to get into identity verification. This is another aspect that the gene banks can provide for the user community. We have geneticists, and we work closely with geneticists that are developing fingerprinting techniques. We're using molecular markers, but we're also using sequences to confirm identities of particular cultivars. We've just done a study on boysenberry, for example, finding the original boysen type and variants. And this is useful where people want to confirm that the plant materials they have in their collection are, in fact, what they're named. This kind of information, the accession inventory and evaluation information, is documented in GRIN. We put in observations. We're about to put in G observations, the genetic observations for the blueberry identities, for example. The fingerprints for those blueberries will be uploaded to GRIN soon. So what is happening in the world? There are aphids that are making problems with viruses. There are diseases like mildew in raspberries and blight and crown rot in strawberries. There's new viruses that are being discovered even as we speak. There's new blueberry and raspberry viruses out there that haven't been named before. And there's global warming. And of course, folks need to have plant CSI done. And so who are you going to call to resolve all those issues? The Corvallis Gene Bank and the great staff that we have are ones that can supply information and germplasm to help solve and resolve these issues. So once again, just a little bit, when I started as a curator in 1987, right after that, we had about 5,000 accessions. In the late 1990s, we had 10,000. And now in 2012, we had 12,000 accessions. We've been rotating up and down in terms of our collection. Our distribution in 2015 was 9,000 accessions sent out, and we're creeping back up to that now. And so to do a total count, we had 19,000 orders over the lifetime of the repository, looking back over 38 years. And each of those orders had about 10 requests in them. So that's about 115,000, well, it's not about, it is 115,000 plus items that were shipped out to folks not only in the US, but around the world. And so for foreign requests, we've sent out more than 20,000 items over the course of the repository so far. We preserve genetic diversity. As I mentioned, we take plant collections, and we've had distribution, as I just mentioned, We publish our results, and we have mentored graduate students. Just like Geneva, we have many annual tours. More than 4,000 people come, or 400 people come. And sometimes, once in a day, we can have that. And we interact with scientists. Well, recently, we've had Barbara Reed, who was our physiologist. But now she's processed graduate students. They're no longer here. She retired, and we couldn't replace that position. So we are also, as John Priest was mentioning, in the maintenance mode because funding challenges are in effect. And recently, my colleague, Joseph Postman, his position is going to become vacant because he's retiring. And so we'll have another large set of shoes to fill. So these are a list of some of the staff members we've had over the years, but in the last decade, we haven't been able to replace these positions. We will replace our tree fruit curator because it is a significant mission required position. But we have made a decision to temporarily close our tissue culture lab because we can't afford to do that. And we are moving Janine DeNoma to help with our mint and hop collections in greenhouses and field. But we do welcome you to our gene bank. We hope that you make plant requests from our GRIN database. We are indeed the guardians of the germplasm. Our mission continues to be to preserve genetic diversity for all people for all time. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak here, but I do want to add one little moment of discussion that I hope can lead into our panel discussion. So we started the germplasm system with discussions in ARS and with information, in ASHS, with information from ASHS scientists, people realized that we needed to establish a clonal gene bank system. Well, now, where does the germplasm system fit into the way the world is right now? Because we have a system now where breeders are protecting their material. They're getting royalties back from the material they release. If there's exchange of germplasm other than the system, there can be fees involved. But we in the germplasm system operate on a federal base budget. But people, of course, don't want to increase their taxes. They want to decrease their taxes. How can we approach the need to conserve genetic resources, which is the foundation for genetics and breeding and plant pathology? We work closely. We are the foundation of agriculture. And how can we meet people's expectations? Because I have scientists, even at this meeting, coming and saying, Kim, I made a request and I have to wait. It's just, I need this plant material now. But we don't necessarily have the staff and the resources to provide the instant gratification that's needed by scientists to get their grants done. And so we would like to hear a discussion from the scientists in the room about how we can approach going forward with the National Plant Germplasm System. So I thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'm looking for input from you at this panel.
Thank you, Kim, and please let's have a round of applause for all of our speakers because before we move to the panel discussion. For all of the great talks. So please, can you come and take your positions, and I'll serve as a microphone girl running around. And thank you, Kim, for actually starting the discussion. I was juggling notes, getting it from the talks, and a few of the things that I already knew. Other problem is the land or space, personnel issues. When people retire, there's no intention of replacing the position, but overall the money. And I'm going to go back to use that slide that from Peter Bretting, because there is one slide that we are missing, and I apologize for not actually including it, where it shows the funding for the collections, where it basically goes down and in last few years is steady, but with the raising costs of the maintaining the collections and personnel salaries and needs, that basically means almost cutting down into the operational budget, which oftentimes means missing certain operations in the collections, which jeopardizes actually the existence of the collection itself. There is a movement on the among the scientists from the American Seed Trade Association, National Association of Plant Breeders, Plant Breeding Coordinating Committee, and other non-governmental agencies to raise the profile and visibility of the importance of the National Clonal and other gene bank repositories in the U.S. to the capital, to basically one saying was really eye-opening when the spokesperson in front of the American Seed Trade Association said, when she approached the people at the Capitol and told them about the importance, they all knew about the Svalbard. Nobody knew, not that they didn't know about our system, but nobody thought about the importance of actually having the living collections. And so we realized how important it is to educate them and come up with maybe a one-pager, something that would caught their attention, because after a few lines they obviously skip and don't read anymore. And so that's something that what we are doing, and what we are asking the community and scientists to share their stories and share where crucial germplasm came from the collection, and because of that collection, certain problem was able to being solved. Because if the collections are not in place, so many issues that we have, like right now in Peach, as John showed, armillaria, which is making a chaos in the southeast and slowly creeping into the western part of the country, we are looking into the repository for the sources of resistance. So I'm opening the panel for questions from the audience and from the speakers if they want to raise another question. So go ahead.
Not quite about funding and quite yet, but I had a question for Larry. When you mentioned the Fusococcum problem, and the fact that Georgia was releasing cultivars that required all those grain, what do the stakeholders and growers feel about those cultivars versus ones that, you know, out of the program that potentially don't need as much? You know, is it the whole economic issue of I think
you said
20 sprays
that they need? The Wichita Vipani cultivars are being adopted in the West, where they don't require the kinds of sprays that they would in the East. When I talk to nurserymen in the East, they are propagating some of those materials, Morill and Bird and things like that. I had a really good conversation with a nurseryman the other day, and I mentioned my reservations about their disease susceptibility, because in our orchards in Texas, which is a much drier environment, we're not spraying, and the materials that we have are scabbing horribly. So, and what they said, you know, what this nurseryman said is, well, that's a myth. You know, they're not that bad. And I said, well, how many times do you spray them? And he's, you know, 15 is a minimum. So if your culture is that you're going to spray, then these cultivars can fit in and they can make money. I don't know how they do it. I don't know how they pay the pesticide costs, but evidently they're doing it and they're being propagated.
And what is the Georgia program, the breeding program?
Well, no, Patrick Connor is in charge of the breeding program, and some of the most recent the releases that he's making are incredibly disease resistant. They're going to change everybody's stuff. Avalon was recently released. It's Gloria Grand Bicato. So it has everything that it's needed. Patrick Connor is with us on the Specialty Crop Research Initiative looking for tools to do a better job. But we know we need to look within diversity. Our wild relatives have reduced tree size, and yet if we keep using the things we've been using, we're going to keep getting the things we've been getting. That's a long-winded answer. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
A couple of comments for John. If you need more land from the university, there's a simple solution. Get a small dump truck and fill it with $100 bills or more. They take it over to the chancellor's office. It's pretty exciting if they see a lot of money.
Well, that's the problem. The money we have for all of us is dwindling, and the future of the two repositories that I manage is what LJ said is going to happen to the Caria collection, that the trees will survive, but there won't be much care of them. What's happening is when Congress votes in a cost of living increase for federal employees, at least since I've been with the government, everyone has been a no-cost increase. So that means it doesn't come out of the taxpayers' base. It moves from our operational portion of our budget into our non-discretionary. It goes into permanent salaries. Plus, we have inflationary pressures. And what I need is labor. And you're right. Money would get me land, but I'm not going in that direction. I'm figuring out how to get the repository to survive as I continue to cut positions, so I've got enough money to fix broken tractors and things.
I I've raised some of these questions to Peter Breding repeatedly as a current state rep on the W6 committee for the seed revival, the regional stations, which are at the same kind of situation as all our bus drivers are in. No different. They have problems with continuing to repropagate their materials and that sort of thing. And the Seed Trade Association has sort of come forward on it, but I think it's time for the private company breeders who use these materials to do the same thing, maybe through HHS.
So what would be your suggestion how to help? Because all of the mentioned people are in the same movement to help, but we need to make sure that it's heard and that it's acted upon, and it's something that is made into the law, so there's no every year, thinking, oh my God, whether are they going to cut the budget or increase? That's something that stays and it increases. Because another thing that I didn't mention is in the next 5 to 10 years, we are going to be losing many personnel from the collections. And there's no educational program in the United States that educates next generation of people that could work in the repositories. We strained into the molecular, we strained into some things where students don't see the living plant. And so there has been, with Gail Walk and Pat Byrne, initiative to group people together and to decide what to do and how to help educate people for the replacement of those positions, because the catastrophic thing is going to happen if retirements happen. We don't have adequate people to replace the position, and what government is going to do, okay, great, we're going to close the position. And that's not what we want. Go ahead.
Just a couple of points. The same session that Dan was referring to on the statement was made that the four largest private table grape breeders had gotten together and formed a fifth company that was focused solely on enforcement of their intellectual property rights. And it occurred to me, if they can do that, it might be worth at least talking to them about the possibility of creating some mechanism to get a small proportion of their proceeds to help support the grape gene bank or whatever other gene bank is appropriate. Secondly, I'd be glad to write a letter. I think that the emerging and now highly evident threat of long bean and citrus, which has devastated the forest citrus industry, provides a prime example of why we need to maintain these collections. And thirdly, there are tools being developed in a number of crops, including citrus, which will permit mobilization of the diversity that you have in your collections and making interspecific hybrids, these early flowering transgenes actually can facilitate conventional breeding, so that LJ, you can make 100 years of progress from conventional breeding in 15 to 20 years, and really mix up all of these fine resources that have been sustained and deserve to be sustained forever.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I could.
Who should I write my letter to?
Send it to me, and then I'll forward it to the people that are actually sitting in Washington and talking to the Capitol people.
I think just to respond to a few of the comments, it's just, an interesting discussion. I think it's important to note that, like, these aren't our collections. Like, these are your collections, right?
Yeah.
Like, we are stewards of these beautiful collections, but, like, really it's yours. And so, like, getting your input and feedback. So, like, as we focus more on, like, core functions, like getting the data that you collect, your evaluation data, like, and putting that back into the repository. And really, like, as we do move to more advanced technology and microbiology and all the other aspects, like CRISPR-Cas and all that exciting new things, like, germplasm will always have a role, right? Like, we're not as imaginative as evolution has been. It's like, we will continue to be the basis, and, like, you know, so that technology only enhances and reemphasizes the need to preserve and use our collections more.
Okay. Yeah, there's many. So Margaret was first, and okay.
Just one quick. The comment came from behind me here about the FBI, and it's an important one, because
a way to deal with this, and this is a little bit different. Maybe we should really think about taking the germplasm system and transferring it into the Department of Homeland Security as the Department of Ag. And the reason I mention that is because the argument can be made that this is a national security issue, and it seems like that's where all the money is. And so maybe it's time to go to Congress and say, oh yeah, this shouldn't be part of Ag anymore. It should be Homeland Security and funding.
What we can do as a researchers that use the collections, as Fred promised, write a letter, send it to either Peter Bretting, send it to me, I'll forward it where it needs to go. Those are all bullets in our fight to get the profile up and to get the funding raised. And so maybe even moving, I mean, it's not far-fetched that this is a national security, because very soon it's going to happen. So Margaret was the...
Well, I'll comment that, you know, about the CRISPR question, you know, Pairwise Genomics, who was one of the panelists on the private industry thing, they have gone to Corvallis, to the repository, to look for diversity and look for new alleles that they want to use to gene editing to improve. So it is still very useful. Then I'll also ask the question, you know, when is the last time, or has there ever been, like, a lobbying day for the germplasm repositories? And do you guys feel like you have, like, any sort of champion in Congress? Like, often it seems like for these initiatives, like SCRI, there's one or two champions in Congress that you go to.
So if I can take a whack at answering some of the questions, we have had lobbying efforts for the National Plant Germplasm System over the course of time. We as federal employees cannot lobby for ourselves. So the American Seed Trade Association has been quite effective, and for the past, say, when we got our last increase, which was in 2006, and we've been flat pretty much for the last decade in most cases. There's been some ups and downs. But they enabled a doubling of the gene bank funding over a period of about 10 years. And they lobbied not only Congress, but they went and lobbied staffers at the White House so that you could have all sides of the coin, because that's what makes the legislation. Now, the challenge with horticultural crops is we are diverse. We have grapes that think they're the best, and we have blueberries that, oh, come on. And so what we need to do is pull together our horticultural commodities and have a united horticulture effort that spreads across not only California, but other states. Every state in the union has a horticultural interest of some sort, at least evaluating horticultural crops. And so that could be something that senators could rally around to go.
Yeah, Nahla.
This is really to make recommendations about something practical that we can do and that you can do.
Yes.
I would like to suggest that. The first thing, there is an opportunity here. All four of you are going to be writing articles, right?
So
there is an opportunity here for all of us. In practical terms, all four speakers are going to be writing articles for the Journal of the American Pomological Society about each of the germplasm repositories. And I think, Xenia, I'm suggesting that she could get input from all of you how using those germplasm repositories have helped solve a practical issue in each of your industry. So if you could send her how it has helped you, you know, Driscoll's, Apple, anybody, so she can compile that, and then those are outcomes that are very, very practical that anybody who is going to be lobbying on our behalf, on behalf of the NPGS system, they need that. so that they can go. So they want to see how it has impacted the industry. And these are things sometimes we do not get input on at the germplasm repository. We know we send you things. We don't sometimes know how you use them, what you've used them for. That's what we need from you, right?
Yes.
And I think if you, at the end of that, make, you know, say these are the impacts. They are very practical, you know, so it would help us. And then each one of you have your own stakeholders, your own groups that lobby on your behalf. So that you can use those,
yes,
as, you know, impacts that they can go to Congress with to, you know, lobby on our behalf.
Take every opportunity you have to lobby. So, who's next? Sorry, David? Okay. And then.
ASHS, as big a republic, they actually have, at times at least, retained a lobbyist in Washington who would know their, who are the important people, know where the bodies are buried. Is there some opportunity to work with ASHS I think it's a great idea to put together a letter, a white paper consisting of information from everybody in this room and perhaps many others, stating the problem, the advantages,
yes,
provided by the National Clonal Germplasm System, documenting the financial problem, and asking for specific steps to be made to increase the budget realistically, if given that the resources are always limited. And then work with somebody from ASHS who's actually a professional lobbyist and can gain access to the right doors.
David, we are doing that with the National Association of Plant Breeders, and we are collecting the stories, but the horticultural part is so swamped with the field crops. And there are a few of us on these meetings when we show how we do the breeding. It's like a completely different story, the problems we have. So what Nahala suggested is a great way for me to have something to actually give to the NAPB and people that sit in Washington, D.C. and talk to all of those young people over there. I go there, I don't know how the system functions, but they know and they lobby. And NAPB is the association created out of the Plant Breeding Coordinating Committee, which is the Land Grant University Agricultural Experimental Station organized committee. We cannot lobby as a committee, but NAPB can. And so they need ammunition. They need testimonials. They need white paper, one pages, or just a paragraph.
So that's why I'm saying you can, in introducing the workshop,
yes,
write the impact. And anybody can use that. We can use that.
Yes.
That information is available at present if you go to the regional technical committees for the four regional stations.
Yes, it is, but nobody's going to go there. That's what we are trying to say.
If you want that information, it is in those reports. You can extract it right now. You don't have to go and collect it.
It's there now. All the information then.
Yeah. We collect it. I'm state representative for California. I have to prepare a report which has all this stuff. And we query everybody in the state who uses plant germplasm, including all the horticultural germplasm. It is there if you want.
Dan, I'll make sure to go through the W6 report that you turned in, because I know you do an excellent job of getting some information on use of the germplasm. So, but it doesn't include everything. But
yes,
we'll
it doesn't. And so we have 5 more minutes, so let's go through a few more that wanted to say something. Go ahead.
So funding, of course, is a threat to all of us in our research, but we're also facing other threats. Change the subject slightly to climate change. And so the germplasm collections offer this amazing opportunity for trying to address some of the issues, heat, drought, you know, excessive rain, whatever it is. However, these germplasm collections were selected, their location selected many years ago. And I'm wondering if they're still the right location for some of these collections. And also, maybe you can just comment on the panel about some of the impacts you've seen from climate change in your collections that you have.
I can start on that, because Brooks and Barden made the suggestion of actually There were a lot more clonal repositories that they wanted to see, but it got boiled down to the ones that are still existing. For example, there was a citrus gene bank in Florida, but then over time it was somewhat redundant because of the quarantine requirements. Anyway, Riverside is the place that it got put. Now we have one long being that is challenging Riverside. But we were selected because the plant materials that we have grow well in the areas in which we are, and also because of the political lobbying pressure to make sure that grapes in New York State and grapes in California were taken care of. So grapes are in New York and California for that reason. So there's where does it grow well, and so I'll leave the citrus off. I don't know about that. But in terms of the berries and our assignments, it's the right place for the genetic resources we've been assigned.
Okay. Let me address the climate change part of the question, because I thought that was a good question. 2015, and I think it was 2016, we had really poor chilling. And it pretty much knocked out the California pistachio crop. And We saw effects of that on some accessions, and other accessions did fine with the amount of chilling we had. And so there's a lot of diversity. And we haven't actually done a controlled environment study, but just looking at observing the plants in the field, you see huge differences.
I think it's an interesting question for us. One of the most valuable things that I see in our collection is test systems that are established, that as we document them in relation to their microsite, we see patterns in our test systems of soil changes across orchards. And that's reflected in the phenotypic data we've collected over time. And since those test systems are resilient and they'll continue to live, they're a wonderful laboratory to fly over with remote sensing and to develop techniques that we don't have. So I think it's dangerous to have any one-size-fit-all solutions. I love what Peter Breding's saying about maintenance. It's like, that's where I am. I'm a horticulturist. We need to maintain what we've got. We don't have enough people that I can... I'm watering greenhouses, and I love it because it puts me in touch with my trees. You talk about we need... training of kids. You can't train a kid to want to go out in the Texas heat and do something active. It's like they either have it or they don't. But if they have it, what we should be doing in ARS is maintaining the collections that we have. And then we have our cooperators come in, the scientists and the industry, and work off of that hub. But if we don't maintain what we've got, then we lose a resource that nobody's going to replace. It takes too long, at least in my crop. So I think those are good questions, and I don't know the answers, but I think the alliance with the industry is huge, and we need to be doing better at it. And that's why Georgia has succeeded as well as they have, because the industry came in under them and supported them and supported a breeding program, and they delivered what their industry wanted. We've got to do more of that. But the germplasm that we maintain won't be recollected and won't be transferred and won't be rebuilt. We are it, and we're enough, and it'll stay if we can do minimal stuff to just hang on to it.
Okay, so two quick comments.
Well, I may be naive about what the process would actually be, but a number of commodities have checkoffs marketing, and in some cases, research. This seems like, what the repositories need is a little slice of that same pie. I don't know exactly how the process would be enacted to do that. For commodities that already have, marketing checkoffs, it seems like what the repositories need isn't a huge amount of money. And in a forward-looking industry, you would think, would be supportive of that.
They don't like paying for maintenance. I mean, I've hit various industries, and I think it's the idea of giving money to the government. And so I cannot get the grape industry to prune my grapes. It costs $20,000 a year to prune the grapes. If I could have that $20,000 that I could put into the collection, it would make a huge difference. But the walnut people have helped out a little bit one year on pruning walnuts, but it's tough to get maintenance money out of industry.
Yeah,